Chapter 11. Archetypes. Guiding Principles of the Psyche and the Cosmos. Archetypes are cosmic primordial patterns and governing principles. They are universals that function as templates for the particulars of the material world. As Jungian psychologist James Hillman pointed out in his groundbreaking book, Revisioning Psychology, the term archetype can be applied to a broad range of objects, processes, and situations. It could be, for example, the immaterial potential of structures, like invisible forms of crystals that can materialize in a solution, snowflakes or patterns of ice that can form on the windowpane, instinctual behavior in animals, the genres and topoi in literature, the basic syndromes in psychiatry, the paradigmatic thought models in science, and the worldwide figures, rituals, and relationships in anthropology. There are many metaphors for describing the archetypes. According to Hillman, there is no place without gods and no activity that does not enact them. Every fantasy, every experience has its archetypal reason. There is nothing that does not belong to one god or another. In this chapter, we will explore the aspects of the archetypes that are most relevant for psychonauts undergoing inner journeys and practitioners working with holotropic states of consciousness. The Greek term archetupos means first molded, from arche, meaning beginning or origin, and tupos, meaning pattern, model, or type. Archetypes are abstract universal matrices that are themselves transphenomenal, but they can manifest in many different ways and on many different levels. Richard Tarnas described three important perspectives from which archetypes can be seen in his book Cosmos and Psyche, Intimations of a New Worldview. 1. As mythological principles. Homer, Greek tragedy, world mythology. 2. As philosophical principles. Philosophy of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. 3. As psychological principles, psychology of C.G. Jung. The mythological manifestations of archetypes can be traced back to the dawn of human history. They have played an important role in the shamanic lore and in the ritual and spiritual life of native and ancient cultures. The figure of the shaman in and of itself is an archetype that has manifested through the ages in many human groups and in many countries. The universal image of the shaman has existed in many variations and inflections, reaching back probably 30 to 40,000 years into the Paleolithic era. In the chapter on the history of psychonautics, we discuss the images of Paleolithic shamans from the walls of the caves in southern France. The sorcerer and beast master in Les Trois Frères, the shaman in the hunting scene from the Lascaux cave, and the dancer from Le Gabillou. Additional archetypal images from the Paleolithic era are the Venus figures and figurines symbolizing female fertility, Venus of Willendorf, Venus of Dolny Vestonice, Venus of Lucelle, Venus of Hohlfels, Venus Impudique, and many others. The initiatory crisis of novice shamans in various cultures has characteristic archetypal sequences. The journey into the underworld, attack by evil spirits, severe emotional and physical ordeals, and experiences of annihilation dismemberment, and psycho-spiritual death and rebirth, followed by a magical journey into the solar realm. Many cultures have rich, eschatological imagery, including the posthumous journey of the soul, the abodes of the beyond, paradises, heavens, and hells, and scenes of judgment. The archetypal iconography in the ancient books of the dead is especially rich. The Tibetan Bardo Todol, Egyptian Pert Emhru, Mayan ceramic book of the dead, Aztec Codex Borgia, and the European Ars Moriendi. India abounds with stunning archetypal sculptures, reliefs, carvings, and paintings of this nature. The artistry and sophistication of archetypal symbolism reached the culmination point in the tantric traditions of the three major Indian religions: Hinduism, Buddhism, and Jainism. Intricate figurative paintings and sculptures represent the dynamics of the serpent power, Kundalini, maps of the subtle body and its energy centers, chakras. Different aspects of the two main deities of Tantra, Shiva and Mahakali, and various stages of cosmogony and of the spiritual journey. Intricate tantric abstract symbolism makes it possible to portray various deities and spiritual themes as yantras, abstract images composed of points, lines, triangles, squares, spirals, and stylized lotus blossoms. Within Vajrayana, Tibetan Mahayana Buddhism, there are scroll paintings called tunkas, which are used as meditational aids and teaching devices. These feature mandalas, complex images combining rich figurative archetypal iconography with geometric symbolism. Many of them depict scenes from the bardos, the intermediate state between incarnations. Similar rich iconography can be found in Chinese and Japanese Buddhism. These depict peaceful and wrathful deities, heavens and hells, episodes from Buddha's life and his previous incarnations, jatakas, and many other motifs. Rich pantheons of archetypal figures, realms, and stories existed in other ancient cultures as well. Egypt, Babylonia, Assyria, North and Pre-Hispanic America, African kingdoms and tribes, Australian Aborigines, and other indigenous cultures. In the Homeric epics and Greek drama, archetypes take the form of gods, archai, demigods, and legendary heroes, such as Zeus, Hera, Poseidon, Hades, Apollo, Artemis, Aphrodite, Hermes, Heracles, Jason, Theseus, or the centaurs. Greek mythology also offers complex archetypal scenes: the gods' feast on Olympus, scenes in Tartaros, the underworld, and in the paradisian Elysian fields, the battle of the Titans with the Olympian gods, and the labors of Heracles. This rich archetypal world provided inspiration for Greek sculptors and painters, and the artists of the Italian Renaissance. The Greek culture also articulated, in great detail, another major perspective on archetypes, seeing them as philosophical principles. The tendency to interpret the world in terms of archetypal principles was one of the most striking characteristics of Greek philosophy and culture. The classical archetypal perspective was formulated by Plato. He was building on the early philosophical discussions about the first universal principles, archai, by the pre-Socratics, Heraclitus, Thales, Anaximenes, and Anaximander. They discussed whether these principles were fire, water, air, or a limitless, boundless substance, Apeiron. Plato also drew on Pythagoras's teachings on transcendent mathematical forms, and particularly on the wisdom of his teacher, Socrates. For Plato, archetypes were transcendent universal principles superordinated to the world of particulars. They formed and informed the material world. In Plato's terminology, archetypes were called ideas or forms, coming from the Greek word eidos, meaning pattern, essential quality, or nature of something. It did not mean idea as it is understood in the Western world, the product of an individual human psyche. The archetypes possessed an independent existence in a realm beyond heaven, hupo uranios topos, which was not accessible to ordinary human senses. They could be experienced in holotropic states of consciousness by initiates in ancient mysteries and in temple incubation in the temples of Apollo, or apprehended by the enlightened intellect. German Vernunft, not Verstand. According to Plato, the only real knowledge is the knowledge of the forms. In his dialogue Timaeus, he gives the reason for this. The form keeps its own shape unchangingly. It has not been brought into being and is not destroyed. For example, something is beautiful to the extent to which the archetype of beauty is present in it, or the extent to which it partakes in the archetype of beauty. However, the archetype of beauty itself is eternal and cannot be either added to or diminished. The concept of archetype, form, idea, does not apply just to abstract qualities, but also to material objects, animals, and people. What makes the key a key is that it contains the keyness archetype, and the dog is a dog to the extent to which it partakes in the archetype of dogness. We can also talk about the archetype of humanness, which is anthropos, the cosmic man. Each archetype has its nondescript general form, as well as many specific inflections and variations. Alex Gray's remarkable collection of images called Sacred Mirrors shows humans of different races, gender, and age, and their skeletal, muscular, nervous and circulatory system, as well as their subtle bodies, nadis, chakras, meridians, and auras. In biology, we can talk about the archetype of the skeleton of vertebrates and the specific analogs that its parts can take in different species. For example, analogs of human or simian forearms and hands would be the wings of birds or bats, the front legs of felines, and the flippers of whales, dolphins, sea lions, and penguins. Excellent examples of archetypal domains are mathematics and geometry. Like Pythagoras, Plato did not see numbers as something that the human mind invented for ordering and counting material objects, but as transcendent numinous principles woven into the very fabric of existence. Above the door to the Platonic Academy in Athens was an inscription, "Let no one ignorant of geometry enter here." Hungarian-American physicist, mathematician, and Nobel Prize winner Eugene Wigner published the essay Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in Natural Sciences, in which he expressed his astonishment that mathematics, allegedly a product of the human mind, can model and even predict phenomena in the material world. He wrote, "The enormous usefulness of mathematics in the natural sciences is something bordering on the mysterious, and there is no rational explanation for it." Jungian psychologist Marie-Louise von Franz wrote a book called Number and Time about the archetypal meaning of the first four numbers, integers. She presented many specific examples, drawing both on psychology and hard sciences, and concluded that natural number is the common ordering factor of both physical and psychic manifestations of energy, and is consequently the element that draws psyche and matter together. Von Franz, Pauli, and Jung saw this as an indication of the existence of unus mundus, a psychophysical reality beyond the split into matter and psyche, a potential world out of which causeless new creations can emerge. Observer and the observed phenomenon come from the same source. Synchronistic events show the moment when this potential world incarnates into the concrete. Synchronistic events show the moment when this potential world incarnates into the concrete. Geometrical figures, such as the triangle, square, circle, rectangle, pentacle, six-pointed star, spiral and double spiral, and Platonic solids, tetrahedron, cube, octahedron, dodecahedron, icosahedron, sphere, pyramid, and cone would be seen in Platonic philosophy as transcendental ideas. Additional examples of sacred geometry are pi, the golden section, the chambered nautilus shape, or the Fibonacci series. More recent examples are fractals, computer-generated graphic representations of nonlinear equations, emulating the shapes of trees, ferns, vegetables, seashells, and ocean shores, etc. Swiss researcher Hans Jenny was able to create archetypal shapes by vibrating plates covered with Lycodium powder at various frequencies. He described his experiments in the book Cymatic Soundscapes. The concept of ideas is closely related to being and becoming. The world of particulars is mercurial, subjected to constant change, and nothing ever remains the same. This is the reason why Buddha warned that attachment to material things is a source of human suffering. The world of ideas is superior in comparison with the material world. It is real, eternal, reliable, and always remains the same. The ideas are enduring, which makes them similar to gods. This is why Plato believed that the only real knowledge is the knowledge of forms. Plato's student and successor, Aristotle, brought a more empiricist approach to the concept of universal forms, one supported by rationalism that is based on logical analysis that was secular rather than spiritual and epiphanic. In the Aristotelian perspective, the forms lost their numinosity, but gained a new recognition for their dynamic and teleological character as being concretely embodied in the empirical world and in the processes of life. For Aristotle, the universal forms primarily exist in things, not above or beyond them. Moreover, they not only give form and essential qualities to concrete particulars, but also dynamically transmute them from within, from potentiality to actuality and maturity. Aristotle's archetypes would guide the development of an acorn into an oak tree, a caterpillar into a butterfly, an embryo into a mature organism, and a child into an adult. After the essential character of the forms has been fully actualized, decay occurs as the forms gradually lose their hold. In biology, the problem is not only what gives the final form to different organisms, a mosquito, parrot, whale, or human being, but also what is the nature of the force that is capable of guiding their development through the millions of cellular divisions in all the stages of embryogenesis, from the fertilized egg to a mature form. It was the study of embryogenesis of various forms of life and their ability to compensate for noxious experimental intervention that inspired Hans Driesch to postulate the existence of an intelligent force in nature, entelechy, and to found vitalism. The problem of universals, more specifically Plato and Aristotle's concepts of archetypes, was one of the central themes in the debates of medieval scholastic philosophers. They were divided into three groups. The realists defended Plato's original idea that archetypes had independent existence in a realm that lay outside of our universe. The nominalists asserted that universals are mere names, abstractions from what we see in the material world. The third group, the conceptualists, claimed that universals exist, but only in the mind. They have no external or substantial reality. The idea of the archetypal or universal underwent important developments in the later classical, medieval, and Renaissance periods. Realism reached its culmination in the philosophy and art of the High Renaissance. In the following centuries, with the development of empiricist science, the concept of archetypes radically shifted toward nominalist philosophy. The archetypal perspective remained vital in the arts, in classical and mythological studies, and in Romanticism. It seemed that the archetypal vision was all but extinguished by the increasing emphasis on reason. Immanuel Kant's discovery of a priori categories and forms of the human mind, which order and condition all human knowledge and experience, and the ensuing revolution in philosophy, brought a re-emergence of the archetypal perspective. It caused a radical shift from the object of knowledge to the knowing subject that influenced virtually every field of modern thought. In the 20th century, the concept of archetypes underwent an unexpected renaissance. It was foreshadowed by Friedrich Nietzsche's book, The Birth of Tragedy, and his discussion of the Dionysian and Apollonian principles shaping human culture, and increased exponentially with the development of depth psychology. Sigmund Freud had a keen interest in mythology and was a passionate collector of antiquities. His former apartment and office at Berggasse 19 in Vienna is now a museum replete with Greek, Roman, and Egyptian artifacts from his own personal collection. Freud's term Oedipus complex was inspired by the tragedy Oedipus Rex by the Greek playwright Sophocles. And in his latest formulation of psychoanalysis, he chose the mythological names Eros and Thanatos for the two drives competing in the human psyche. However, Freud saw mythological stories as reflections of the problems and conflicts that children have in the nuclear family. He did not achieve a real understanding of the transpersonal domain and of the archetypes. C.G. Jung added an important new chapter to the history of archetypes by defining them as psychological principles and bringing supportive evidence for the realistic perspective. Jung's thinking was influenced by Kant's critical epistemology and Freud's instinct theory, but he eventually transcended both of them. His understanding of the human psyche represented a major extension beyond Freud's biographical model. Like Freud, Jung put great emphasis on the unconscious and its dynamics, but his concept of it was radically different than Freud's. Jung's epoch-making departure from Freud's psychoanalysis started when he was analyzing a collection of poetry and prose of the American writer Miss Frank Miller, Miller Fantasies. During this work, he discovered that many motifs in her writings had parallels in the literature of various countries around the world and different historical periods. He was able to find the same phenomenon when he was analyzing the dreams of his patients, fantasies and delusions of schizophrenics, and his own dreams. He concluded that we do not only have the Freudian individual unconscious, a psychobiological junkyard of rejected instinctual tendencies, repressed memories, and subconsciously assimilated prohibitions, but also a collective unconscious. He saw this vast domain in the psyche as a manifestation of an intelligent and creative cosmic force, which binds us to all humanity, nature, and to the entire cosmos. The collective unconscious has a historical domain that contains the entire history of humanity, while the archetypal domain harbors the cultural heritage of humanity, mythologies of all the cultures that have ever existed. In holotropic states, we can experience mythological motifs from these cultures, even if we do not have any intellectual knowledge of them. Exploring the collective unconscious, Jung discovered the archetypes, or universal principles governing its dynamics. He first referred to them as primordial images, using a term that he had borrowed from Jakob Burckhardt. Later, he called them dominants of the collective unconscious, and finally settled on archetypes. According to the understanding that has emerged from Jungian psychology, scholarly mythological research, and modern consciousness research, archetypes are timeless, primordial, cosmic principles underlying and informing the fabric of the material world. Jung initially thought that archetypes were not trans-individual, but intra-psychic patterns hardwired into the brain, which he compared to animal instincts. A major step in his understanding of archetypes was his discovery of synchronicity. As a result, Jung came to regard archetypes as expressions not only of a collective unconscious shared by all human beings, but also of a larger matrix of being and meaning that informs and encompasses both the physical world and the human psyche. In the postmodern period, archetypes became increasingly influential not only in post-Jungian psychology, but also in other fields such as anthropology, mythology, religious studies, philosophy of science, process philosophy, astrology, and others. The concept of archetypes was elaborated, refined, and enriched through an increased awareness of archetypes' fluid, evolving, multivalent, and participatory nature. Archetypes in psychiatry and psychology. Modern consciousness research has shown that in holotropic states, archetypes can be directly experienced and bring new information about mythologies of the world that are otherwise unknown to the subject. In my books, I have given many examples of situations in which my clients experienced or even embodied archetypal figures and witnessed mythological sequences. Jung described an interesting observation of his that occurred during grand rounds in a locked psychiatric ward. At one point, he noticed a chronic psychotic patient who was staring very intently out of the window. He asked him what he was watching. The patient responded, "Don't you see it? The sun has a penis and is making wind by moving it back and forth." Jung later discovered, to his great surprise, what this patient experienced was a motif from Mithraic mythology. Archetypes have profound theoretical and practical implications for psychiatry, psychology, and psychotherapy. They play an important role in the genesis of emotional and psychosomatic symptoms as part of coex systems. Understanding archetypal dynamics is thus essential for healing and transformation. This is closely related to the inner self-healing intelligence of the psyche, Jung's individuation process, and the healing potential of archetypal figures or cosmic energies that ancient and native cultures saw as divine. Some examples of this include the archetype of Apollo in the Greek temple incubation, the deities of the Caribbean and South American syncretistic religions, the Loa in Voodoo, or the Orishas in Umbanda and Santeria, and the serpent power, Kundalini, described in the Indian scriptures. Many psychonauts experimenting with sacred plants experience guidance from what appear to be the spirits of these plants in their sessions, such as Mescalito from peyote, or the great mother goddess Pachamama from ayahuasca. Of particular interest in this regard is a complex archetypal sequence known as the hero's journey. It is very important not only for psychiatry and psychotherapy, but also for comparative religion, because it plays a key role in the ritual and spiritual history of humanity. It is an archetypal pattern that is essential for understanding shamanism, rites of passage, the ancient mysteries of death and rebirth, and the great religions of the world. The concept of the hero's journey emerged from the research of Joseph Campbell, the greatest mythologist of the 20th century. He first described this motif in his 1947 classic, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. He referred to it as a monomyth because of its universal and ubiquitous nature, which transcends historical and geographical boundaries. Campbell later demonstrated, in joint seminars with leaders of programs at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California, John Perry, Sam Keen, Chungliang Al-Huang, and Stanislav and Christina Groff, how this archetypal sequence is essential for understanding a broad range of phenomena, including shamanic initiatory crises, rites of passage, ancient mysteries of death and rebirth, Dante Alighieri's Divine Comedy, the lives of saints and mystics, socio-political events, and spiritual emergencies. The work with holotropic states has shown beyond any reasonable doubt that archetypal experiences are not erratic products of brain pathology of unknown origin, endogenous psychoses, but creations of anima mundi emerging into individual consciousness. The discovery of systematic correlations of planetary transits with the timing and content of holotropic states of consciousness is the most powerful evidence for this fact that I have seen. Another critical proof is the phenomenology of John Perry's renewal process, a type of spiritual emergency that mimics the themes of Royal New Year's dramas that were performed in ancient cultures during the archaic era of incarnated myth. The work with holotropic states has also revealed the existence of the perinatal domain of the unconscious that contains a unique mixture of fetal and archetypal elements. The archetypes and science. Modern materialistic science joined the centuries-old philosophical argument between the nominalists and realists and emphatically decided in favor of the nominalists. The existence of hidden, invisible dimensions of reality is an idea that is alien to materialistic science, unless these are material in nature and can be made accessible through the use of devices that extend the range of our senses, such as microscopes, telescopes, or sensors detecting various bands of electromagnetic radiation. Academic and clinical psychiatrists use a very narrow conceptual framework that limits the human psyche to postnatal biography and the Freudian individual unconscious. According to them, the archetypal beings and realms are not ontologically real. They are figments of human imagination or pathological products of the brain that require treatment with tranquilizing medication. In holotropic states of consciousness, the archetypal figures and domains can be experienced in a way that is as convincing as, or more convincing than, our experience of the material world. They can also be subjected to consensual validation. Deep personal experiences of this realm help us realize that the worldviews found in ancient and native cultures are not based on ignorance, superstition, primitive magical thinking, or psychotic visions, but on authentic experiences of alternate realities. Archetypal figures fall into three distinct categories. The first one includes personages embodying various universal roles and principles. The most famous of them are the Great Mother Goddess, the Terrible Mother Goddess, the Wise Old Man, the Eternal Youths, Puer Eternus and Puella Eterna, the Lovers, Death, and the Trickster. Jung also discovered that men harbor in their unconscious a generalized representation of the feminine principle, which he called anima. For her counterpart, the generalized representation of the masculine principle in the unconscious of women, he used the term animus. The unconscious representation of the dark, destructive aspect of human personality carries the name shadow in Jungian psychology. The archetypal figures of the second category represent deities and demons related to specific cultures, geographical areas, and historical periods. For example, instead of a generalized universal image of the Great Mother Goddess, we can experience one of her specific, culture-bound forms, such as the Christian Virgin Mary, Sumerian Inanna, Egyptian Isis, Greek Hera, Hindu Lakshmi or Parvati, and many others. Similarly, specific examples of the Terrible Mother Goddess would be the Indian Kali, pre-Columbian serpent-headed Coatlicue, Greek Medusa or Hecate, Balinese Rangda, or the Hawaiian Pele. It is important to emphasize that the images, which emerge into consciousness in holotropic states, can be drawn from the mythology of any culture in human history. They do not have to be limited to our own racial and cultural heritage. The third group of archetypal figures are holographic agglomerates, which represent an age, gender, race, culture, role, profession, etc. The soldier, the child, the mother, the Jew, the conquistador, the tyrant, the martyr, etc. These images are from the different collective experiences of these categories. The Jews from all historical periods, all the soldiers who have fought on the battlefields of the world, all the mothers or children of the world, and so on. Similarly, it is possible to experientially differentiate the archetype of the wolf from the experience of the consciousness of a wolf pack. Many times over the years, I have observed that my clients, participants in workshops, and trainees in psychedelic and holotropic breathwork sessions experienced obscure archetypal figures and motifs from little-known cultures, which I was later able to identify. Frequently, I did this with the help of my close friend, Joseph Campbell, who was a walking encyclopedia of world mythology. The most remarkable examples of this kind that I remember was an experience from the mythology of the Malekulin culture of New Guinea, and another one from the Inuit Eskimo mythology. These are the cases of Otto and Alex in The Ultimate Journey. Archetypes play an important role in the genesis of scientific theories and in scientific discoveries. As Philip Frank has shown in his remarkable book, Philosophy of Science, The Link Between Science and Philosophy, the source of the basic axiom of a scientific theory, or the idea that leads to a scientific discovery, is often an archetypal motif. In the history of science, revolutionary ideas often emerge long before there is sufficient evidence to justify or support them. The Ionian philosopher Anaximander proposed, in the 6th century BC, a proto-evolutionary theory suggesting that all life originated in the ocean. Greek philosophers Democritus, 4th century BC, and Leucippus, 5th century BC, formulated an atomic theory of matter, suggesting that the material world consists of tiny, indivisible particles, atomos, meaning one that cannot be cut any further. Nicholas Copernicus and Johannes Kepler drew the inspiration for their astronomical theories from the solar archetype, and German chemist Friedrich August Kekule von Stradonitz was inspired in his discovery of the benzene ring by a vision of the archetype Ouroboros, a snake devouring its tail, as we have seen. There is also increasing awareness of the importance of archetypal patterns in various scientific disciplines. Johann Wolfgang von Goethe was fascinated by the building plan of plants, especially by the archetypal leaf concept, which considers floral organs to be modified leaves. Goethe formulated a theory of plant metamorphosis in which the archetypal form of the plant is to be found in the leaf. He wrote, "From top to bottom, a plant is all leaf, united so inseparably with the future bud that one cannot be imagined without the other." Goethe's research has created the foundations for many domains of modern plant biology. British-American anthropologist, biologist, and philosopher Gregory Bateson was fascinated by the pattern that connects in nature and in evolutionary theory. He considered it the main feature that differentiates living organisms from inorganic objects. British plant physiologist and parapsychologist Rupert Sheldrake formulated the theory of morphogenetic fields and morphic resonance to account for the existence of forms and order in nature. In his discussion of the nature of morphogenetic fields, Sheldrake made reference to archetypes. He pointed out that the morphogenetic fields have the properties that the immutable Platonic forms found in the mathematical world of perfection. He pointed out that the morphogenetic fields have the properties that the immutable Platonic forms found in the mathematical world of perfection. As we saw earlier, these forms exist outside of time. However, Sheldrake has another hypothesis involving formative causation that has Aristotelian features. Here, nature itself can produce forms utilizing evolutionary creativity. Archetypes, religion, and spirituality. The discovery that the archetypal world is ontologically real gives legitimacy to the spiritual worldview, the spiritual quest, and to religious activity that involves direct experience. It makes it possible to distinguish organized religions based on belief, with their dogmatism, ritualism, moralism, and secular ambitions, from the authentic spirituality that is found in the monastic and mystical branches of religions, and in groups emphasizing spiritual practice and direct experience. Spirituality is based on personal experiences of non-ordinary aspects and dimensions of reality. It does not require a special place or an officially appointed person mediating contact with the divine. The mystics do not need churches or temples. The context in which they experience the sacred dimensions of reality, including their own divinity, are their bodies, psyches, and nature. Instead of officiating priests, they need a supportive group of fellow seekers or the guidance of a teacher who is more advanced on the inner journey than they are themselves. By comparison, organized religion is an institutionalized group activity that takes place in a designated location, such as a sanctuary, church, or temple, and at a specified time, and involves a system of appointed officials who might or might not have had personal experiences of spiritual realities. Once a religion becomes organized, it often completely loses the connection with its spiritual source and becomes a secular institution that exploits human spiritual needs without satisfying them. Organized religions tend to create hierarchical systems focusing on the pursuit of power, control, politics, money, possessions, and other secular concerns. Under these circumstances, religious hierarchy, as a rule, dislikes and discourages direct spiritual experiences in its members, because they foster independence and cannot be effectively controlled. When this is the case, genuine spiritual life continues mostly in the monastic orders, mystical branches, and ecstatic sects of the religions involved. Historically, mystics did not have easy relationships with organized religions of the same creed, as exemplified by the fate of Joan of Arc and many victims of the Inquisition, and in the story of the martyrdom of Sufi Halaj and the persecution of the Sufis in Muslim countries. During his 1937 Dwight Harrington Terry lecture at Yale University, C.G. Jung suggested to those in the audience for whom the rituals of conventional religion had lost their efficacy that they might consider moving beyond the confines of established religion and practice direct experiential encounters with the unconscious. Properly followed, this intra-psychic ritual could bring an immediate religious experience and lead to the emergence of a highly personalized spiritual wholeness. What Jung had in mind in 1937 was a ritual to be enacted within the sacred circle of one's own psyche. His discovery of synchronicity dramatically transformed his earlier notion of this ritual. The idea of an immediate religious experience may now be understood as referring to a ritual which is to be enacted within the sacred circle of nature as a whole. Jung's definition of true religion was the network of genuine spiritual seekers transcending the boundaries of space and time. Search for a new planetary myth. Scholars such as Arnold Toynbee and Joseph Campbell noticed that all past cultures were governed by an underlying myth or a combination of myths. Joseph Campbell often asked the question, what are the myths that are driving the Western civilization? He himself emphasized the importance of the myth of the search for the Holy Grail in its relation to the individualism characterizing Western society. King Arthur's knights decided not to search for the Holy Grail as a group, but each chose his own individual path in the woods. We can also think about two major myths of the modern era that Richard Tarnas explores in his The Passion of the Western Mind: Paradise Lost versus The Ascent of Man. The motifs of the psycho-spiritual death-rebirth, abduction and rape of the feminine, and a variety of others, including Faust, Sorcerer's Apprentice, Frankenstein, and Prodigal Son, seem to be equally appropriate. Joseph Campbell also often asked, what will be the myth of the future? And he expressed his hope that it would involve overcoming fragmentation and creating a planetary civilization where people would live in harmony with others and with nature, benefiting from the astonishing discoveries of science and technology, but using them with a wisdom that comes from a deep spiritual understanding. Hoffman's New Atlantis. Achieving this goal would also involve psycho-spiritual rebirth and liberation, and the return of the feminine. Since we are talking about planetary civilization, I would like to mention a very interesting observation that seems especially relevant. One of the most surprising discoveries in my work with psychedelics and holotropic breathwork was the ease with which my clients, trainees, and workshop participants in holotropic states of consciousness transcended historical and geographical boundaries and experienced archetypal figures, motifs, and domains from so many cultures in human history. Michael and Sandra Harner observed a similarly wide cross-cultural range of experiences in 1,500 Westerners who were exposed to shamanic drumming. Over the years, during my own psychedelic sessions, I have experienced episodes from different mythologies and religions of the world, including Hindu, Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist, Muslim, Christian, ancient Egyptian, Shinto, Australian Aborigine, Native American, and South American. This must be a new phenomenon because many cultures used powerful mind-expanding technologies, including psychedelic plants, and if the entire collective unconscious had been as easily accessible for them as it seems to be for modern subjects, we would not have distinct culture-specific mythologies. We have to assume that, for example, the Tibetans experienced primarily Tibetan deities, and for the Huichol Indians, primarily Mexico Huichol deities. There are no descriptions of the deer spirit, or grandfather fire in the Bardo Todol, or those of the Dhyani Buddhas in the Huichol lore. We can discover different inflections of the same archetypes, but not culture-specific forms related to other cultural groups. It seems that this increased accessibility of various domains in the collective unconscious parallels what is happening in the material world on planet Earth. Until the end of the 15th century, Europeans did not know anything about the New World and its inhabitants, and vice versa. Many human groups in remote parts of the world remained unknown to the rest of the world until the modern era. Tibet was relatively isolated until the Chinese invasion in 1949. Today, telephone, shortwave radio, television, jet travel, and more recently, the internet have dissolved many of the old boundaries. Let us hope that what is happening in the inner and the outer world are indications that we are moving toward a truly global civilization. Dangers of archetypes for psychonauts. The most common danger associated with the experiences of the archetypal world is what C.G. Jung called inflation. It means assuming the numinosity and luster of the archetypal world for oneself and attaching it to one's body and ego. According to Joseph Campbell, echoing Carl Fried Graf Durkheim, a useful deity or archetypal figure has to be transparent to the transcendent. It has to point to the absolute, but not be mistaken for it. Making the archetypes opaque and worshipping them is another important danger and pitfall on the spiritual journey. This results in religions that unite people within its radius who are willing to believe and worship in their particular way, but separate them from everyone else, dividing the world into rival groups. Christians against pagans, Muslims against infidels, Jews against goyim, etc. Even differences in interpreting the basic tenets of the same religion can result in internecine encounters and centuries of bloodshed, as we see in the centuries of atrocities between Catholics and Protestants, and Sunnis and Shiites. The ability to see through or beyond the archetypes to the absolute, which is the source of all religions, determines whether the result will be a mystical worldview or idolatry. The realization of the ontological reality of the archetypal world validates the ritual and spiritual life of pre-industrial cultures. Shamanism, rites of passage, mysteries of death and rebirth, and the great religions and spiritual philosophies of the East and West. Of these, the rites of passage are of particular importance for modern society. According to scholars such as Margaret Mead and Mircea Eliade, the fact that the industrial civilization has lost meaningful, socially sanctioned rites of passage contributes significantly to the ills of modern society, particularly of the young generation, sexual acting out, drug abuse, and violence. In 1973, Joan Halifax and I, who were at the time newlyweds, were invited by anthropologist Margaret Mead and her daughter Catherine Bateson to a small working conference entitled Ritual, Reconciliation in Change. The conference was sponsored by the Wenner Gren Foundation, a small anthropological association located in Lower Manhattan in New York City, and took place at Berg Wartenstein in Austria. There were 18 participants in this conference, and all of us had to write preprints, since Margaret hated formal lectures. The meeting lasted 6 days, and we met twice a day around the castle's giant round table for brainstorming sessions. The topic was Margaret's idea, mentioned above, that the problems we have with teenagers are caused by the fact that the industrial civilization has lost rites of passage. The task of the discussion was to determine if it was possible to artificially recreate rites of passage, or if they have to emerge organically from the history of the tribe or culture. All of us recognize the importance of rites of passage, and were interested in the possibility of recreating them using some combination of already available techniques, such as ropes courses, outward-bound survivor kind of approaches, stays in wilderness, and firewalking. Due to the political climate, it was clear that it was not realistic to consider using psychedelic plants and substances for this purpose, which would be a logical choice in view of the many centuries of experiences from native cultures. The group came to the conclusion that non-pharmacological experiential therapies would be a reasonable temporary substitute. Unfortunately, Margaret was not able to overcome the administrative challenges and implement her interesting idea. The efforts to reinstitute rites of passage have continued to this day. Additional validation of the ontological reality of archetypes came from informal experimentation with psychedelics, entheogens, and with powerful non-drug experiential techniques. Of the many experiences involving the archetypal world I myself have had in psychedelic sessions, the most interesting one happened in a session with a high dose of MDMA in a pilot study conducted by Sasha Shulgin and Leo Zeff. About 50 minutes into the session, I started experiencing strong activation in the lower part of my body. My pelvis was vibrating and releasing powerful streams of energy in ecstatic jolts. At one point, this exploding energy swept me along in an intoxicating frenzy into a whirling cosmic vortex of creation and destruction. In the center of this monstrous hurricane of primordial forces were four Herculean archetypal figures performing what seemed to be the ultimate cosmic saber dance. They had strong Mongolian features with protruding cheekbones, oblique eyes, and clean-shaven heads decorated each with a large braided ponytail. Whirling around in a frantic dance craze, they were brandishing large weapons that looked like scythes or L-shaped scimitars. All four of these combined formed a rapidly rotating swastika. I intuitively understood that this monumental archetypal scene was related to the beginning of the process of creation and simultaneously to the final stage of the spiritual journey. In the cosmogenetic process, with its movement from the primordial unity to the worlds of plurality, the blades of the scimitars represented the force that is splitting and fragmenting the unified field of cosmic consciousness and creative energy into countless individual units. In relation to the spiritual journey, they also seem to represent the stage at which the seeker's consciousness transcends separation and polarity and reaches the state of original, undifferentiated unity. Here the scimitars functioned like a blender, transforming the individual separate units into an amorphous mush. The direction of this process seemed to be related to the clockwise and counterclockwise rotation of the blades, represented by the peaceful and ominous versions of the swastika. Projected into the material world, this archetypal motif seemed to be related to growth and development, the fertilized egg or seed dividing and becoming an organism, or destruction of forms, wars, natural catastrophes, decay. Then the experience opened up into an unimaginable panorama of scenes of destruction. In these visions, natural disasters, such as volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, crashing meteors, forest fires, floods, and tidal waves, were combined with images of human-made desolation, burning cities attacked by air raids and rocket fire, entire blocks of collapsing high-rise buildings, mass death, and the horrors of war. Heading this wave of total annihilation were four archetypal images of macabre riders symbolizing the end of the world. I realized that these were the four horsemen of the apocalypse: pestilence, war, famine, and death, on colorful horses. The continuing vibrations and jolts of my pelvis now became synchronized with the movements of this ominous horseback riding, and I joined the dance, becoming one of them, or possibly all four of them at the same time, leaving my own identity behind. Suddenly, there was a rapid change of scenery, and I had a vision of the cave from Plato's Republic. In this work, Plato describes a group of people who spend their whole lives chained in a cave, facing a blank wall. They watch shadows projected on the wall by things passing in front of the cave entrance. According to Plato, the shadows are as close as the prisoners get to seeing reality. The enlightened philosopher is like a prisoner who is freed from this illusion and comes to understand that the shadows on the wall are illusory, as he can perceive the true form of reality rather than the mere shadows that are seen by the prisoners. This was followed by a profound and convincing realization that the material world of our everyday life is not made of stuff, but that it is a virtual reality created by cosmic consciousness through an infinitely complex and sophisticated orchestration of experiences. It is a divine play that the Hindus call Leela, created by a cosmic illusion, or Maya. The final major scene of the session was a magnificent ornate theater stage featuring a parade of personified universal principles or archetypes, which were cosmic actors who create the illusion of the phenomenal world through a complex interplay. They were protean personages with many facets, levels, and dimensions of meaning that kept changing their forms in extremely intricate holographic interpenetration as I was observing them. Each of them seemed to simultaneously represent the essence of his or her function, as well as all the concrete manifestations of this element in the world of matter. There was Maya, the mysterious ethereal principle symbolizing the world illusion, Anima, embodying the eternal female, a Mars-like personification of war and aggression, the lovers, representing all the sexual dramas and romances throughout the ages, the royal figure of the ruler, the withdrawn hermit, the elusive trickster, and many others. As they were passing across the stage, they bowed in my direction, as if they were expecting appreciation for their stellar performance in the divine play of the universe. This experience brought me a deep understanding of the meaning of the archetypal motif of the apocalypse. It suddenly seemed profoundly wrong to see it as being exclusively related to the physical destruction of the material world. It is certainly possible that the apocalypse will actually manifest on a planetary scale as a historical event, which is the potential of all archetypes. There are many examples of situations in which archetypal motifs and energies broke through the boundary that usually separates the archetypal realm from the material world and shaped history. The giant asteroid that killed the dinosaurs 65 million years ago, the wars of all ages, the crucifixion of Jesus, the medieval witches' Sabbath and dance of death, the hell of the Nazi concentration camps, and the Buddhist hot hell of Hiroshima are just a few salient examples. The primary importance of the archetype of the apocalypse, though, is that it functions as an important landmark on the spiritual journey. It emerges into the consciousness of the seeker at a time when he or she recognizes the illusory nature of the material world. As the universe reveals its true essence as a virtual reality, as a cosmic play of consciousness, the world of matter is destroyed in the psyche of the individual. It crossed my mind that this might also be the meaning of the end of the world referred to in the Mayan prophecy. In this case, it would relate to the radical inner transformation that humanity would go through during the period of the sun's transit over the axis of the galaxy, lasting at least 72 years, during which the body of the sun would be in contact with the galactic axis. We would thus be now in the middle of this period. The magnitude of this transformation would be comparable to the transition of humanity from the age of Neanderthals to the age of Cro-Magnons during the previous transit of this kind about 26,000 years, one Platonic year ago. Or from the age of hunters and gatherers to the age of agriculture and the building of cities. The precessional transit of the sun on the other side of the galaxy, approximately 13,000 years or half a Platonic year ago.